Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Waiting for Hope by Karen J. Haisley, narrated by Callie Bollier. Chapter 1. Sad to say, all my childhood memories are connected in some way to the sanctuary. I regret that truth, not because of what the sanctuary was, but because my mother and I took up residence there when I was 6, and thus all the years of my life prior to that move are irretrievably lost. I cannot recollect any home other than that handsome red brick building, although mother and I must have lived somewhere before she and Ellie Fontana struck up the commercial relationship that brought us to the most famous bordello on the Northern California coast. Noted in A Gentleman's Guide to San Francisco, Sanctuary, as it was familiarly known by both boarders and customers, was a narrow, three-story building with steps leading up to an imposing front door flanked by pillars entwined with sculpted ivy. As a child, I thought the place elegant and beautiful. But I suppose, if I saw it today, I might consider its flocked wallpaper and ornate decor flamboyant, even tasteless. But through my child's eyes, when the sun shone through the red half-circle window over the door and reflected a rosy light against the hallway walls inside, it was as if I'd been transported to a place of magic. Sanctuary was not a place of magic at all, of course. Far from it. But it was the only home I can remember throughout my childhood. I came to the sanctuary a biddable, quiet, and ignorant child until the professor opened up the world of books to me. A more appropriate name for the man would have been the piano player, because that's what he did nightly at the parlor house. But his spontaneous quoting of Shakespeare and the fact that he always carried a book in an inside pocket earned him the affectionate scholarly nickname. Entering Sanctuary's kitchen one quiet afternoon, I stopped in the doorway to stare at the professor as he sat at the old oak table, his head bent over whatever small volume he had with him at the time, immersed in the story and oblivious to anything going on around him. I couldn't imagine what in that little book was able to hold his rapt attention and keep him so still. I was as engrossed in watching him as he was in reading until somehow, feeling my eyes on him, he looked up.
"Here's a little Miss Mouse," he greeted, teasing. "I heard there was a kid around somewhere."
He noticed my gaze fastened on the small volume on the table and asked,
"Haven't you ever seen a book before?"
Pushing the book across the table toward me.
"Here, take a look."
I came forward and picked up the leather-bound volume, handling it as if it were fragile.
"I can't read," I finally admitted regretfully. I put the book down on the table, conscious of an almost overwhelming sadness.
At that moment, I never wanted anything as much as I wanted to be able to read what was on those pages.
"A grown-up girl like you? Well, that's not good." He studied my face soberly. "You've got your mother's eyes, Miss Mouse. But I see something else in that little face of yours. I'm guessing there's a bright mind there, too."
Then, more to himself than to me, he added,
"No need to follow in her footsteps if you can find a better way."
From then on, the professor made it a point to arrive earlier than he was needed, and using the clever combination of good literature, newspapers, and the labels of common household items, he began to teach me my letters. I was very quick and loved reading from the start, and I believe he enjoyed his self-assigned role of teacher as much as I loved the printed word. When I proudly read my first complete literary sentence to him, unassisted, the professor startled me by laughing out loud. I had chosen the book from several he had scattered on the table earlier in the week and had worked on the first page so diligently that I fell asleep at night clasping the novel.
"It is a truth, universally acknowledged," I began, "that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife."
I didn't stumble over any of the words, even acknowledged, which had taken me a while to figure out, and I didn't understand what he found amusing in my reading. For a moment, I hesitated. A child among adults all my life and having learned caution at an early age because of it, but his eyes remained kind. His had been the laughter of a quiet joke, not directed at me specifically, and not mocking. So, after another reassuring glance at his face, I bent my head and started reading again. I didn't understand everything I read, but I loved the rhythm of words and the sound of the story. Loved, too, the puzzle of reading, putting the pieces together and making sense of it all. I was too young then to understand the irony of that particular sentence in our circumstances at the sanctuary and why it must have struck the eccentric professor as funny. I understand better now. Besides reading, he taught me arithmetic and writing, both of which came easily and never caused me a moment's puzzlement or labor. With the professor's encouragement, I scribbled, as my mother always called it, from my early years, created stories and poems, wrote letters to imaginary friends, started the habit of maintaining a journal that I continue to this day. His was the only schooling I ever had, but it was more than enough. I never knew the man's real name, and by the time I was 9, Ellie did away with the piano entirely, so I never saw him after that and didn't have the chance to thank him for what he gave me. But because of the professor, I discovered the better way, he mentioned, and didn't follow in my mother's footsteps. To this day, I wish there was some way I could let him know how those few hours a week so many years ago changed the course of my life. My mother, who was indifferent to both reading and writing, never knew what to make of my predilection for learning. At times she would be weakly scornful, unsure of its attraction for me, perhaps wondering what changeling had been left on her doorstep, who could lose herself for hours in the printed word. At other times she would show me off to the girls in the house. "Look at my Hope," Mother would say. "That girl has more brains than all of us together." Pride was clear in her voice. But something else, too. Something more ambiguous and harder to interpret. Perhaps emphasizing my intellectual accomplishments allowed her to ignore the fact that I was growing up and filling out in other ways, and she was growing older. I spent most of my early years trying to stay one step ahead of my mother, trying to love and understand her, and in the way some children reverse the roles, trying to protect her. I couldn't explain why I thought she needed my protection. She was 16 when I was born, no longer a child in either years or experience, and she was beautiful. As a very little girl, I can recall her straight, smooth, golden hair fanning out about her shoulders on the pillow. I can see myself tracing the line of her perfectly arched brow with my finger as she slept, surprised when she awakened, those brilliant green eyes laughing at me, perhaps loving me. I was never quite sure of that. Mother was mercurial at best, often despondent and at other times so brilliantly gay her presence lit a room and made lamps unnecessary. Because morning was the only time I had any real freedom and she of necessity slept well into the afternoon, my time with her was limited. Although we usually lunched together, I never knew what to expect from day to day and so learned to be quiet and watchful until I could take a cue from her. Was she lethargic and exhausted, requiring me to be very quiet and speak only when spoken to? Or perhaps she would be brittle and short-tempered, letting me know in her special way that nothing I said or did pleased her. The very good days saw her happily pleased with herself, satisfied and content with whatever had happened the night before. My mother never struck me or even raised her voice to me, but I would have preferred those actions to her way of coldly ignoring me if I did something to displease her, whether I was aware of my fault or not. She was all I had in the world, and her censure, whether open or implied, stung. Being plain-spoken and straightforward by nature, I found the times almost unbearable when she disregarded my presence, as if I were invisible, cheerfully talking to others in the room and disavowing any knowledge of a daughter as I sat before her in plain view, mute, furious, and resentful. Eventually, the incident would pass, and she would once again speak to me, never sharing whatever I had done to make her unhappy, and always assuming she had taught me a lesson by her silence. She had, but not the lesson she had intended. On the rare occasions when Mother talked about her childhood, usually when alcohol made her voluble, She painted a dismal picture of a Northern California farm. Endless drudgery, long days of field work, too many mouths and not enough food to feed them, not enough love or attention either, although she never said that in so many words. She left the farm at the age of 14 with a traveling actor of so little consequence to her that she never mentioned his name, and I doubt could remember it. It was he who had brought her to San Francisco. Sometime after that arrival, she met up with a woman named Ellie Fontana, and the rest of the story I knew. Ellie was an up-and-coming businesswoman, one of the most elegant and successful madams in San Francisco, and it didn't take either of the women long to decide that they could form a flourishing and successful business relationship using Mother's beauty and Ellie's brains. To Mother's credit, she worked out an agreement with Ellie that permitted me to stay with her. I know now how rare and infrequent such an arrangement was, but my mother insisted that she would reside at the sanctuary only if I resided there too, and Ellie eventually agreed to it. Ellie Fontana knew her fortune was tied up with my mother in those days because it was my mother's ability to charm both in the parlor and in the bedroom that first brought the influential and powerful men of the city to the house. Over the 8 years I was there, Ellie added many more women to the sanctuary, all young, attractive, and well-mannered, but my mother was always the Queen Bee, and her clients requested her by that name, Queen Bee. The sanctuary was a house for men, equipped with every luxury and extravagance necessary for their comfort. Growing up as I did, surrounded almost exclusively by women, I wondered what it was men did that was so arduous and trying that they must be pampered and indulged with fine wines, soft furniture, and even softer women. I could gaze down from my third-story room and catch glimpses of the men who frequented the sanctuary, men who looked well-dressed and well-fed, hardly men who had borne the rigors of the elements and grueling hard work. Why should so much be at their disposal and dedicated solely to their well-being? When I asked my mother that question, she was in one of her good moods and responded very seriously, "The world was made for men, hope, and everything in it is at their disposal. Do whatever you must to stay on their good side. Never forget that." Just as she said, I never forgot her advice, but I never followed it either. Mother could have become a wealthy woman. She was often requested by affluent customers who would have only her, but she loved beautiful things and fine food, and so it seemed we were always poor. She periodically reminded me that I was a great part of the reason we stayed in debt. There was a charge for my stay at the sanctuary, exorbitant, I'm sure, as all of Ellie's charges were. My room and board and all of my clothes came out of my mother's percentage of the business, as well as her own personal expenses. Later, I discovered that Ellie encouraged my mother to buy beautiful and overpriced gowns and hats from several local dressmakers and milliners. By pre-arrangement, the merchants put the cost on Ellie's account so that my mother remained forever in Ellie's debt. No doubt, Ellie Fontana received kickbacks from the dressmakers as well. Such practices were all part of the business, commonplace and accepted. The rules that applied to the early years of my life were simple. Be neither seen nor heard. Be invisible. Sometimes I picture myself as a ghost child in that big house, a silent phantom drifting quietly up the back stairs to my little room as soon as the bell on the front door tinkled and Ellie called out, "Company, girls!" For Ellie, I held the danger of notoriety. She kept a discreet and quiet parlor house, with only moderate alcohol, no excessive profanity, tasteful music and decorous dancing, polite conversation, and stylishly decorated rooms where her girls entertained their customers. Ellie would have feared the outrage of some respectable, reforming San Francisco matron if it were discovered that a little girl lived on the premises of a brothel. The notoriety would have ruined her business had the sanctuary been splashed across the newspapers. What respectable man of any prominence or importance would risk being seen after such scathing publicity? And prominent, important men, respectable men, were Ellie's bread and butter. So I was made to understand very clearly that I must never be seen on the premises by any of the guests. My mother had other concerns. I believe she felt a certain fear for my safety. knowing there were men who would have preferred a child to any woman they were offered. But I think, too, that mother was not a role the queen bee often felt like playing. She was much more at home as the beautiful, flirtatious, charming courtesan, able to make any man feel he was king in whatever role he chose to act out. Motherhood did not fit the part, and could hardly be expected to act as an aphrodisiac for her or her clients, so I must be carefully hidden from view. Sometimes one of the maids was allowed to take me on a walk in the park, and I could spend as much time as I wished in the kitchen with cook, but company girls always sent me scurrying up the back steps. If it had not been for the books the professor brought me, I might have believed that life at the sanctuary was all a woman should expect and followed unquestioningly in my mother's footsteps. But once books opened other worlds to me, I knew I wanted something different, something more. Even at so young an age, I began to plan for a real home of my own. My mother never shared who my father was. Now I think that was because she wasn't entirely sure, but as a child, I imagined something more glamorous or tragic. A heroic father lost at sea or gone on some romantic excursion to China or India, never to return. It never crossed my mind that my mother may have had so many partners she could not identify with any certainty the man who fathered me. I led a strangely sheltered life in the midst of such sin and indulgence, and peculiar as it may seem, it wasn't until I turned 14 that I began to make sense of my surroundings. Until then, sanctuary was the only life I knew. Protected by the women, the dressers, the bouncer, the professor, and the day help, I never felt threatened or fearful and was disturbed only infrequently by noises that reached my top story. Once I was awakened by the sound of gunshots, but because no other sounds followed, I thought it had been a dream and promptly went back to sleep. In the morning, except for several lamp globes missing in the first floor hallway, nothing seemed the worse for wear, and no one mentioned anything untoward. Another time, one of the new girls, a pretty plump thing named Lottie, came down to lunch with a fresh bruise along one side of her face. She sat forlornly at the table, unable to stop crying. But when I approached Lottie to offer some comfort, my mother sharply forbade me to address the weeping girl or acknowledge her tears. She has to learn that once the door closes, her wishes are unimportant. Lottie had to learn a hard lesson last night, and she won't soon forget it. Let her cry. It was the closest my mother ever came to telling me what her life was like, and I remember thinking, at the time, that when I grew up, I would never allow myself to be trapped in a place where my wishes were unimportant. Except for those two occasions, I don't recall anything that made me uncomfortable or afraid. My childhood was queer and solitary, but not unhappy. Those were times that preceded today's civilized San Francisco, times when the city was extravagantly unrestrained. How could I, a child, have known to be ashamed of the activities at the sanctuary when adults in my world accepted them as commonplace? Through the early years, my mother aged gracefully, growing into a woman of great beauty and voluptuous figure. But sometime between my 10th and 14th birthdays, her health began to falter, the decline taking a toll on both her face and figure. Too much laudanum, perhaps, or some illness associated with her trade. After I turned 14, my familiar, carefully constructed existence collapsed. One late afternoon, I slipped downstairs to retrieve my journal that I'd forgotten below in the kitchen. Returning up the narrow back steps to my room, I met a man coming down. Such an occurrence was rare, but not unheard of, and I did what I had been taught to do years ago. Lower my head and not make eye contact. Hunch my shoulders so I would appear as small as possible and move sideways quickly to glide past him. The man smelled strongly of alcohol, and as we passed, he put both hands on my shoulders and pushed me hard against the wall, almost causing me to lose my balance and tumble down the stairs. I gave a little cry and fell against him. "Well, what's Ellie been keeping from me?" the man asked, lifting my chin with a finger to stare at my face. His arrogant and drunken tone and his manhandling of me both frightened and infuriated me. I had never felt so angry.
Leave me alone, I demanded with disgust. You're drunk, and reached up to push him away. He said something foul and bent to kiss me. As I struggled and cried out, Ellie came to the foot of the stairs, then hurried up to where we stood. So this is where you are, Marcus. Lottie is waiting for you in the parlor. I'd wondered where you'd gotten to. She talked to him in a friendly, almost motherly tone and pulled him gently away from me and down the steps as if I really were invisible. I was angry that Ellie hadn't chastised him for his behavior, and I was revolted and appalled by the man's smell and sound and touch. So, this was what my mother tolerated night after night after night. I truly had no idea. The next day, Ellie, mother, and I met in the front parlor. Ellie Fontana was a stout, handsome woman of indeterminate age with a prominent nose and dark eyebrows over black eyes. She was as much a part of my childhood as my mother. But that morning, she observed me with cool detachment, as if seeing me for the first time. "Hope is turning into a beauty," she remarked to my mother. "We need to do something with her." The two women eyed each other without speaking until my mother finally looked away. Then Ellie turned to me. "You're old enough to understand the business we have here and the services the sanctuary provides, aren't you, Hope?" "Yes," I replied, although I had only the most rudimentary knowledge. My mother never spoke to me of the more intimate details of her profession. All I knew I picked up from oblique references by some of the other girls, and they were always careful not to say too much in my presence. "Does it hold any interest for you?" Before I could answer, my mother said, "Absolutely not. I will not have it, Ellie," with great vehemence. She was usually so lethargic in her speaking that I was taken aback by her forceful tone. Ellie, ignoring mother and examining me with dollar signs just behind her eyes, spoke to me again. "Hope?" I looked at Ellie Fontana squarely, remembering the man from the night before and the uncomfortable combination of anger and fear and helplessness I had felt. "I'd hate it more than anything else," I told her bluntly. "You'd have to force me." Ellie nodded, unsurprised. "There are some places that would do just that, but not in my house." Then she added, "So, what are we going to do with you?" Speaking more to herself than to mother or me. "You're too grown up to stay here any longer." When I looked over at my mother, she wore a curious expression of relief mixed with sadness. Had she been concerned for my well-being or only worried that as she grew older and more worn by time, I might pose some kind of threat or competition because of my youth? It was a disloyal thought, but sometimes I understood her better than I wished. I would never be a beauty like my mother, but youth has its own attraction, and perhaps she feared the comparison. Finally, Ellie said, not unkindly, "Hope's a good girl, Bee. Smart and quiet, even-tempered and strong. She can go into service. It's time she got out into the world anyway and discovered what life is all about. I know people who know people. I'll find a place where they'll treat her well." My mother hesitated only a minute. "All right," she said. And the matter was settled. When the time finally came for me to leave the sanctuary, I received a small, tearful farewell from nearly everyone in the house. Some of the girls were hardly older than I and astonished that I could possibly prefer working as a servant to their own choice of profession. I only laughed and asked them not to think me too crazy. They had come to the sanctuary to escape a harsh world, I told them, but I had yet to experience the world, harsh or not. These were not bad women, just girls like myself, using what they had been born with to survive in a world unkind to females, but I had known for a long time that their choice was not the choice for me. From books, I had discovered that somewhere was a life different from the sanctuary, a life better. And I was determined to find it, determined to have a home of my own someday where I would be subject to no one's whim or caprice, neither man's nor woman's,
a life dependent on no one but myself. I believed I could take care of myself, believed there was nothing I could not accomplish if I only planned well and worked hard. In my journal, I had written the words from the book Jane Eyre as a reminder. I can live alone if self-respect and circumstances require me to do so. I need not sell my soul to buy bliss. I wasn't sure what a real home would look like, but I knew I'd recognize it when I saw it, and I was single-minded in my purpose to have a home someday without having sold my soul in the process. I was 14, and all my dreams lay before me like a paved road extending as far as I could see into the distance, into the future. On my final morning at the sanctuary, my mother sat with me in the front parlor, one hand folded into mine, neither of us speaking. She looked drawn and thin, and the sudden surge of tender protection I felt for her nearly brought me to tears. She sat next to me on the overstuffed sofa, now and then stroking my hair away from my face in the common gesture of mothers everywhere. Finally, she turned me to her and put a palm against my cheek. "Listen, Hope," she said, her tone both urgent and sad. "Be prepared for the worst. People are unkind, and men are not to be trusted. Don't tell anyone who your mother was and where you came from or how we lived. People will hold that against you. It's not fair, but that's just the way it is. Make something of yourself. You have more of a head on your shoulders than I ever had, and the times are changing." She drew me against her and hugged me hard. "Make something of yourself, Hope," she repeated. Then the doorbell rang, and I heard a woman's voice asking for me. Ellie came to stand in the parlor doorway. "Are you ready, Hope?" I nodded, speechless now that the moment of departure had really come, picked up my small bag, and stood up. Ellie pressed a little pouch of coins into my hand as I passed her. "Hold on to this," she whispered, "and never be apart from it. A woman may need a stake when she least expects it." I thanked her and turned to wave a small goodbye to my mother, who smiled weakly in return. Ellie had called me a woman, but I didn't feel grown up then, only nervous and excited and more than a little apprehensive about the future. When the door closed behind me, I went down the walk with my new companion, and I never looked back. Chapter 2. The years I spent in service at the Gallaghers' Nob Hill Mansion were sometimes monotonous to the point of numbing boredom, sometimes frustrating, physically tiring, and tedious. To be fair, however, they were as equally educating, enlightening, and necessary. From the beginning, I knew there were things I needed to learn in order to be independent someday and have a home of my own, things I could not learn in a brothel. I needed to know the everyday activities of living that most people took for granted, cooking and sewing and cleaning, housekeeping activities that most women learned from their mothers, but which I had never been taught. All of that is what I learned in the Gallagher's house. For me, the worst part of those years was the loss of reading time. The household staff started its day before sunrise and worked until well after supper, often until dark. The long, leisurely, unencumbered days I had enjoyed at the sanctuary disappeared. Thus, as determined as I was to save money, I allowed myself one extravagance from my small earnings. An oil lamp that allowed me to read or write in my journal after I was supposed to have gone to bed. At the time, I imagined my literary activities to be a well-kept secret shared only by my roommate and me, but now I believe all the servants in the house knew about my habit and indulged me. When I arrived at the huge house in San Francisco's most affluent neighborhood, I met the other live-in staff. Pansy, a girl close to my age, and Mrs. Payne, the housekeeper. Besides Bertha, the day cook, I spent most of my time, whether waking or sleeping, with those two women. I soon realized that I had a lot to learn about taking care of others and of myself, much more than I expected. Mrs. Payne, a gray-haired widow with a constantly weary expression, discovered that although I was always willing to do whatever she asked, I usually didn't know how. So she wisely and patiently started me on basic chores. My first
sample complete. Ready to continue?